universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Dear friends, one of the beautiful lessons which we learn from the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam is this fact that the head and the source of jurisprudence is Imam Ali alayhi salam. Of course, now keeping in mind that the fiqh, the jurisprudence of Imam Ali alayhi salam, is the very same jurisprudence of the Holy Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam. And so in reality, the fiqh, the jurisprudence of Imam Ali, the explanation of the divine rules, the divine laws, the religious laws, the sharia of Allah is Imam Ali, and the teacher and the master of Imam Ali is the Holy Prophet Muhammad. Now, as far as attributing Imam Ali alayhi salam to be the fountainhead of the 12er Imam sect of Islam, regarding the fiqh, of course, there is no room for argument here, for he is the source and the teacher. And scholars and jurisprudents of the 12er Imam sect have derived their knowledge from Imam Ali alayhi salam and his infallible progeny, the Imams to come after him. Now, if we want to expand a little bit, because of course it is unanimous among both Sunnis and Shias, Muslims and non-Muslims, that the most powerful and the strongest teacher and the strongest source of knowledge for jurisprudence in Islam is Imam Ali alayhi salam, the best and most perfect student of the Holy Prophet Muhammad. Now, talking about the Sunni brothers, we see that the Hanafiya sect, whose leader is Abu Yusuf and Muhammad, and both of these individuals derived their jurisprudence from Abu Hanifa, who is the student of Imam Sadiq, who was the student of his father Imam Baqir, who was the student of his father Imam Sajjad, who was the student of his father Imam Hussein, who was the student of Amir al-Mu'mineen, the commander of the believers, Imam Ali alayhi salam. Now, the school of thought of Abu Hanifa, the Hanafi Sunni Muslims, is the largest sect, the largest Islamic denomination amongst the Muslims and amongst the Sunnis as well. And so it is interesting to know that the leader of the largest Islamic denomination, namely Abu Hanifa, was a student of the sixth divinely appointed Imam, who received his knowledge from none other than Imam Ali alayhi salam. And so truly Imam Ali alayhi salam is the one where jurisprudence reaches back to. A very beautiful and profound lesson. If we want to know what the true divine laws of Allah are, we will have to turn towards the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
For the protection on the day when property will not avail, nor sons except he who comes with a heart free from evil.
وأسألك الأمان يوم يعض الظالم على يداي يقول يا ليتني اتخذت مع الرسول سبيلا.
And I ask you for protection on the day when the unjust one will bite his hands, saying, Oh, would that I had taken away with the messenger.
وأسألك الأمان يوم يعرف المجرمون بسيماهم فيؤخذ بالنواصي
And I ask you for protection on the day when the guilty shall be recognized by their marks, so they shall be seized by the forelocks and the feet. And I ask you for protection on the day when a father shall not give any satisfaction for his son, nor shall the child give any satisfaction for his father. Surely the promise of Allah is true.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Now we invite you to listen to Brother Hassanain Rajabali.
I'm drawing these stories, brother, for you to understand the state in which our Imam lived in, the difficulty that he lived in, but his love of Allah, his responsibility to protect Islam was so impeccable that he ensured that Islam was not divided. The munafiqeen, the hypocrites, were so plentiful that any move you make comes against you. Allahu Akbar. This religion, great gift of Allah, right after our Prophet's departure, it's like this. Yes, you think shaitan is going to allow a religion to bloom? Look back in history. Thousands of religions came. Shaitan has his fingerprints all over the place. Look at the world today that we look around. How confused the world is. How many false stories against Allah and against the messengers have been concocted. Some of them are so ridiculous, you would never concoct a story like that about your own family. Yet in the scriptures of God, you find prophets committing the worst crimes, and they consider it to be holy. They consider it to be okay. This is the reason why Imam is showing us. He said to fight fi sabilillah, to be in this way of path, the right path, don't think it's an easy thing. The world will come against you. Are you ready to pass it? So you find that that Muawiyah, when he solidifies himself, it became that way because people rejected Allah. Prophets of Allah and Imams have always suffered because the people did not obey Allah. They made their jobs much more difficult. Musa alayhi salam, I give an example, frees the Jews, Bani Israel, from the most powerful clutches of Pharaoh, a man who was capable of building pyramids that you and I can't build today. A man who had so much wealth that he called himself God. And Musa alayhi salam, in a simple garb with a simple stick, breaks his back and drowns him. And he splits the sea and takes his people. Even up to that extent, insan, Allahu Akbar. How obstinate, how difficult people are in the world today. That after seeing this miracle, up to that extent, when Musa alayhi salam goes up to the mountain, they say he's died. Can you imagine? They don't even have faith in Allah. The same people who are freed don't even have faith in Musa alayhi salam. Then they start to worship an idol. Look at how Imam Ali answers this problem about why we Muslims today are united. Whether we are Khalifa school or Ahlul Bayt school, but we in principle, as a Ummah, we are united. Our Quran is the same. Our Salah is similar. Our Kaaba is the same. Allah, the center of all discussions, is intact. This is the power of Imam Ali. Otherwise, we wouldn't have had this.
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
Hezbollah had been vanquished. That's perhaps the most significant and upsetting question about the 2006 war.
Much has been said about the 2006 war, about its motives, the behind the scenes, and the circumstances around it, its planning and developments, its details and objectives, as well as its outcome and the lessons learned from the war. Also, much speculation has been made about what led to the war when considering the situation in Lebanon, in the occupying Zionist regime, in Palestine, and in the region, as well as the U.S. role in the war. One of the main issues that needs a close look is what would have happened if the resistance in Lebanon was defeated.
How did Hezbollah defeat Israel?
Part 2.
Speaking of a hypothetical defeat would not be possible without examining the history of Arab defeats. Just as one cannot hypothesize about Hezbollah's defeat without taking into account the nature and identity of the supposed winner. There are two other questions that have to be asked. One is, how did Israel overcome the Arabs? And the other is, how did Hezbollah defeat Israel? Only then can one hypothesize about the consequences of a Hezbollah defeat in the 2006 war. In the first two episodes, we will take a stab at the first question, how did Israel overcome the Arabs? This episode deals with the wars between Israel and the Arabs, especially the battle that the Arabs started with a surprise attack. This is a story of two wars in the last century, one in 1948 and the other in 1973, an account unheard of from officers of the classic Arab armies. This story is based on investigations by the military research branch of the Islamic Resistance. The images take on a different personality when the founder of Israel, David Ben-Gurion, and its guardian, Ariel Sharon, join each other. These are very rare pictures of Sharon welcoming Ben-Gurion during his visit to the strongest line of fortifications in modern history, the Bar Lev Line. It is a chain of Israeli fortifications built along the eastern coasts of the Suez Canal. The Barlev Line was a massive, continuous sand wall that varied in height from 20 to 22 meters and spanned the entire 170-kilometer length of the canal. It was built 12 kilometers into the Sinai Peninsula and was inclined at an angle of 45 degrees. Then, Israel launched a massive propaganda campaign on the impenetrability of the wall and its superiority over France's World War II Maginot Line. Israel claimed the fortifications could destroy the Egyptian army in case they decided to pass the Suez Canal, because the Barlev Line was equipped with an underwater pipe system to pump flammable napalm into the canal and create a sheet of fire. But they were shocked when Egyptian special forces decided to pass the canal by blocking the pipe system. That was the beginning of one of the biggest military operations in modern history. In autumn 1973, every single Arab officer and soldier was on the battlefield holding his weapon and ready to give Israel a forceful response for the 1967 defeat. Arab nations joined forces to reach their goals. Egypt and Syria launched a simultaneous attack on Israel at 2 p.m. on October 6th that fell on Israel's Yom Kippur feast. Artillery attacks targeted Israeli positions from the Syrian front, and thousands of Syrian forces backed by battalions of tanks headed to the Golan Heights. As the Syrian Air Force targeted the Israeli positions, Syrian troops advanced and inflicted a heavy loss and damage to the Israelis, losses that they weren't used to in former wars with the Arabs.
Before the attack, the enemy knew that it was going to be launched from the Syrian front, but doubtful about a strike from the Egyptian front. Therefore, they increased their forces at the Syrian borders. Israel sent its 7th Armored Battalion to the south of Bir al-Saba near the Suez Canal, and in less than 24 hours, Israeli forces were ready for battle on the Golan Heights. Syria began its offensive. The Syrian army attacked the Israeli forces, which were fully prepared. Therefore, we can say we sort of broke down their defensive line, which is one of the most difficult kinds of battle.
Nothing is more difficult than the deadlock the Israeli forces faced on the battleground at Golan Heights. The army managed to destroy many of the enemy's tanks and seize some others. They were almost as good as new, as they were only driven for a few kilometers before being deployed to the Golan Heights. It is said that the tanks were rushed there from the U.S. and the Israeli Army's depots. In fact, the Israeli Army dispatched its entire reserve tank battalions to the front line, its entire reserve force. It implies that an important section of the Israeli armored battalions were destroyed. It was also true for the Israeli Air Force.
In the October 1973 war, the Syrian army changed the known concepts of air defense and air battle. The country's air defense forces used the SAM-6 air defense systems creatively. Therefore, more Israeli aircraft were downed on the Syrian front than on the Egyptian.
It looks those days, at the beginning, that we were caught completely by surprise. Second, the lessons of the war of attrition, especially the capability of our air force, were not learned seriously. Our air force failed in the struggle between the planes against the ground-to-air system.
We knew that in order to destroy one SAM ground-to-air batteries, we have to pay the price of one aircraft. So if we have to destroy 25 batteries, we know that we are going to lose 25 aircrafts. you know it before you start. This is a tough decision to go there, to lose an aircraft or battery. This is how high was the threat of the missiles, that we had to go there, pay the price, destroy the batteries and continue.
In air battles, Syrian pilots successfully targeted many Israeli phantoms in short, decisive engagements.
Almost 30% of the airplanes of my squadron were shot down during the war. In order to be able to continue, you have to build some walls, emotional walls. Pilots, unlike the legend, are a human being. And yes, there were pilots that stopped flying during the Yom Kippur War because of the situation. Not many, but the phenomena was new to us those days.
The Egyptian offensive began with mortars and missiles raining on the Barlev line, a firepower equal to 175 projectiles per second.
There were 1,500 artillery launches every minute. More than 3,000 cannons were used in the attack. Therefore, we managed to cross the Barlev line. We also prevented the enemy from employing its artillery fire and its contingency forces against us.
Egyptian infantry battalions headed toward the eastern coasts of the canal, led by a special unit of vanguard forces. They blocked the napalm pipes. Many of them were killed as a result of the burns they suffered, but they managed to provide the Egyptian troops the opportunity to cross the Suez Canal. The operation began with the Allahu Akbar, or God is Great, code, and led to the passage of the Egyptian army from the waterway, which was a historical achievement. 12 infantry battalions were set to pass the canal and head to its eastern banks within 3 hours. But only half an hour after the first invasion, the first Egyptian flag was raised on the Barlev line, and more Israeli flags were captured within a short time. After 6 hours from the beginning of the operation, 8,000 Egyptian forces crossed to the eastern banks of the canal, while the engineering units managed to set up the first floating bridge that allowed mechanized units to cross the waterway. Egyptian machinery and tanks were already heading to the eastern banks of the passage 18 hours into the conflict. In the evening of October 7th, the number of Egyptian troops that had crossed the waterway had reached 60,000. As they made the passage, Egyptian engineers were using high-pressure water pipes to create holes in the wall of the Barlev line to destroy its foundation. Consequently, Egypt gained control over the Suez Canal's eastern banks. The first hours of the October War were the longest and most difficult for the leaders of Israel since its creation. Israel had been taken aback and couldn't believe what was happening. On the second day of the war, and in compliance with the security pact between the U.S. and Israel, the U.S. directly intervened in the conflict by opening an air route for Israel. Hundreds of planes supplied Israel with its required military equipment, with daily flights carrying hundreds of tons of munitions directly to the Israeli forces on the Sinai and Golan battlefields. The Soviet Union also opened its own air route for Israel on October 10th with 84 airplanes. On the eighth day of the war, Egyptian President Anwar al-Sadat ordered Egyptian armored units to advance deep into the Sinai beyond Egypt's 12-kilometer air defense cover. The decision exposed Egyptian tanks to Israeli military aircraft. Sadat took the risk despite opposition by many of the officers on the battlefield, led by Chief of Staff Sadeddin al-Shazli. Later, Sadat tried to justify his plan, saying he wanted to reduce pressure on the Syrian front.
كان بيعتمد على أساس دفع الفرقة 21 والفرقة الرابعة المدرعة من غرب القناة إلى الشرق.
Sadat's decision on October 14 relied on the success of the 21st and 4th Egyptian Army divisions to cross to the east of the canal. So when we didn't make it, only 400 tanks were left for the offensive. Look at the poor planning here. We had only 400 tanks against the enemy's 900 tanks, and they had air supremacy. How is it possible that such a plan turns out successful? On that day, we lost 250 out of the initial 400 tanks, and the enemy gained the upper hand. Now, did we reduce pressure on the Syrian front after such a blow to our forces and retreat into Egypt's air defense cover? No, we didn't.
These rare pictures show Israeli fighter jets heading to target Egyptian tanks out of the range of Egypt's SAM-6 anti-aircraft missile system as Israeli tanks close in on Egypt's armored personnel carriers and destroy them one by one. It was happening as Sadat was heading to Egypt's National Assembly to tell the world about the Arab Army's spectacular victory against Israel.
Egypt's armed forces made a miracle come true at all military levels.
Despite Egypt's failure in the Battle of the Tanks, the Arabs had the upper hand in the war on the Sinai. Today, when Arab commanders talk of the Arab Army's victory in the 1973 war, they pick an 8-day episode out of an 18-day conflict during which the Israeli army was on the defensive. But from the 10th day on, Israelis gradually began to adopt an offensive tactic. Shrewdly and efficiently, they switched their strategy. In the evening of October 15th, a small group of 7 Israeli tanks made it across the western banks of the Suez Canal to lay siege to Egypt's 3rd Army Division. The move, which later came to be known as the Split, divided the Egyptian army into 2 separate halves. The 2 parts were the Egyptian Army's 2nd Division deployed on the northern side of the canal's eastern banks and the 3rd Army Division on the southern side of the eastern banks, and the split targeted the 3rd Division with the siege. An Israeli force of 330 tanks led by Sharon moved to the western banks of the canal, encircling the Egyptian army's 3rd Division, an enclosure that remained in place for 100 days, even after the end of the war. Sharon's forces also laid siege to the cities bordering the waterway, especially Ismailia and Suez.
All Arab armies joined forces to launch a surprise attack on Israel, but the Israeli army quickly robbed the opportunity the surprise attack had given them. The Arab forces had planned to attack the eastern banks of the Suez Canal, but it was Israel that eventually invaded the canal's western banks. The Egyptian army consisted of the 2nd and 3rd Divisions, and each division was comprised of 5 brigades. The 5 brigades of the 3rd Division were fully surrounded by Israeli forces, leaving the route to Cairo open to the Israelis. Also on the Syrian front, the road to Damascus would have been opened if it was not for the presence of Iraqi and Jordanian forces.
Sharon's forces were there in their full numbers. He had 2 armored brigades, but they failed. He failed in his mission to take over Ismailia. A parachute brigade and 2 commando battalions stood up to the Israeli armored units. It is a great Egyptian lesson of defense.
The Egyptian and Israeli sides met at a point just 101 kilometers away from Cairo, where Sharon's armored brigade had managed to advance to during the war. They signed an end-of-conflict resolution that led to the withdrawal of 100,000 Egyptian troops and more than 1,000 of their tanks from the eastern banks of the Suez Canal to their initial pre-war positions on the canal's western banks. The resolution authorized Egypt to keep only 7,000 forces and 30 tanks on the eastern banks of the waterway.
I should openly say that Sadat thought this is only an act of provocation, while Sir and Hafez Assad considered it a liberation war. These were two completely opposite viewpoints. From the first day of the war, Sadat and Kissinger were in contact and talked about the Egyptian army's key crossing of the Suez Canal and how to stop the war and enter negotiations. This is why Syria almost fought the war alone, except for a few days that Egypt changed its mind and decided to engage in the battle, and even that was not a serious engagement.
Despite the Syrian forces' strong resistance and sacrifices, Israel's mounting pressure on the Golan Front forced the Syrian army to return to the lands it held at the beginning of the conflict. In fact, Israel even managed to occupy more territories than it held after the 1967 war. This is a map of the lands controlled by Israel in 1967 and the extra territories they seized in 1973. It also shows Israeli forces' advancement toward Damascus and the western Suez areas they occupied on the eve of the 1973 war resolution. In spite of the Syrian army's heavy losses, the Syrian president Hafez al-Assad stood firm against U.S. Secretary of State Henry Kissinger. They held 130 hours of negotiations in the spring of 1974. Following the negotiations, Israel agreed to pull out of a vast area of land it had occupied in October 1973, to the point that Assad declared Al-Quneitra liberated.
Was liberation the main objective of the war, or was it an act of provocation to ensure political gains, or was the war meant to achieve a small victory to get even with Israel? This is what war meant, at least for Egypt, not for Syria. But none of these matter. I think the military aspect should be taken into consideration the moment when Arabs decided to enter the battle, be it for honorable ends or not. They decided on the time and the place where the battle was to be started and enjoyed enforcements from Morocco, Algeria, Libya, Iraq, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and Syria. All of them participated in the 1973 offensive. If back in 1967, their governments, officials, and armies could argue that they were on the defensive because they were attacked by the enemy, they had no argument of the sort in 1973. At the time, they initiated the war and were superior to Israel at a ratio of at least 10 to 1 in all spheres. But rather than gaining a clear and decisive victory to set the stage for future gains, they only settled for the imaginative victory of surprising Israel for 18 hours. Thanks to this security and military strategy, Israelis got things in their hands after the 18-hour shocker. The enemy was back, took over the battlefield, and turned Arabs' victory into a military defeat. It also humiliated Egypt's 3rd Army Division by their siege.
وتم محاصرة الجيش الثالث وبإذلال فوق العادة.
The Arab government's 1973 war raised hopes, or at least the possibility, that it would open a new front against Israel. But the Arabs' failures and the outcome of the war made it the final unsuccessful move against Israel that spread a feeling of desperation among a large portion of people in the Arab world.
Let us promise each other that we shall do it earlier than between 2 months.
The whole experience with Menachem Begin is continuing. I can't tell until the end of it. We are just in the middle of it. Menachem is my friend, for sure. We are friends. This is a fact.
You're a man of peace, but yet you can be a man of aggression.
That's right.
Some people were shaken up by Sadat's visit, but I should only reiterate that this movement is stronger than being affected by a visit or any such thing.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به حق تعالی.
In the path of the Imam.
Listeners, we're with you with another episode of this series. Continuing with discussion of Imam Khomeini's ethical virtues, you will hear more on his high carefulness about achieving spirituality and expurgation of the soul. Please stay with us. According to Islamic culture, the remembrance of death is one of the means to gain spirituality and to purify your soul. Remembrance of death revives the heart and reminds the individual that the world is transient. Hence, he should make the best use of the time on this world for self-building. In Islamic narrations, we read, "Increase the remembrance of death, because no servant of God has increased the remembrance of death except God has revived his heart and made death easy for him." The 10th infallible successor of the Prophet of Islam, Imam Ali al-Naqi al-Hadi, peace be upon him, says, Remember the time when you are lying in deathbed in your family. While no physician can prevent your death, nor any friend can benefit you. One of the recommendations of Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, for young students of seminaries was to remember death. He used to tell the students to think that every moment of man's life is a step towards death and grave. Hujjatul Islam Hamid Rouhani says, Imam Khomeini said in his first speech after arriving in Najaf in Iraq, think right from now. Think right from your youth. Every step that you take is towards grave. Every minute that passes in your life, you're getting a little closer to the grave and the place in which you'll be interrogated. What matters is approaching death, and no one has given you a document that you will live for 120 years. Man may die at the age of 25. God forbid he may die just right now. There is no document. You should take heed and expurgate your soul. Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, used to emphasize on purification of the soul or expurgation of the soul and the self, just as the individual acquires knowledge or even more than that. According to Quranic teachings, he believed that the prerequisite for real benefiting of knowledge is to engage in self-expurgation. Later Ayatollah Muhammad Reza Tavassuli recounts an anecdote in this regard. He says, Imam Khomeini used to advise young students at classes saying, expurgate yourselves. Moral expurgation is before acquisition of knowledge, and if man wants to benefit from his knowledge, he should first be expurgated. Dear listeners, Imam Khomeini would advise young students to take two steps in self-expurgation for every step in acquiring knowledge. Ayatollah Hassan Ghadiri says, the Imam not only himself was expurgated, but also he always tried to train students with expurgation. And he used to advise them from time to time, and that through his special method of sincerity and love. Years later, we still recall his advice. He used to say that for every step in knowledge, two steps should be taken in expurgation of the soul. He said, all leaders of false religions have been scholars, but they have not expurgated their souls. Dear friends, Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, used to tell young students to appreciate their youth for worship and attaining good virtues, so that they get accustomed to those virtues. Late Ayatollah Abbas Ali Amid Zanjani related an account. One day, the Imam told the students, try not to let evil characteristics take root in you, because with the passage of time, these characteristics will be firm, and the person will reach the place that it would be impossible to get rid of these characteristics or bad habits. As long as you are young, try to get accustomed to worship. Ayatollah Sayyid Ja'far Karimi also has an anecdote with regards to Imam Khomeini. He says, Imam Khomeini perhaps would remind scores of times, do everything such as writing, studying, research, worship, attaining spiritual virtues in your youth, and make use of the circumstances. Although Imam Khomeini emphasized on worship for young students, he would warn against going to extremes. Martyr Ayatollah Fazlullah Mahallati says, Imam Khomeini would tell students, If the youth stick to recommended deeds, they would be distanced from obligatory deeds. He would even say, those who were too scared left the seminary due to such extremes. Too much worship is tiring for teenagers of people of 15 or 16 years of age. Youth should enjoy legitimate entertainment, but shouldn't sin. He even said, they can wrestle, but not backbite. Ayatollah Ahmad Jannati says, once I asked Imam Khomeini to guide me on spiritual perfection. He said, strive in purity of action. Late Ayatollah Muhammad Mu'min also said, when I was in Najaf, I wrote a letter to the Imam and requested him to advise me, even if it is a general advice. He said, the best advice is the one that God has given in the Holy Quran. Say, I give you just a single advice, that you rise up for Allah's sake. The Imam considered remembrance of God as an important factor for inward building and attaining and preserving of light in the heart and the soul. Later Ayatollah Sayyid Hassan Badala also says with regards to Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, I remember once the Imam said during his ethical classes in Qom, those who take steps in the way of self-building, sometimes there will be small holes of light for them. The more this hole is preserved, the more it will increase. After the class, I asked the Imam how to preserve this luminous state. He answered, that state should be kept through communication with God and remembrance of God, and man should be in remembrance of God as much as he can.
Around the world with reporters.
Hundreds of medical workers have gathered in front of the United Nations office in the capital Sana'a. They denounced the international community for turning a blind eye on the continued seizure of oil ships by the Saudi-led coalition, which has put the war-torn country to a severe fuel crisis.
I suffer from kidney failure and I have to travel 50 kilometers to get to the dialysis center despite the lack of fuel. I need dialysis 3 times a week, but I only get one because of the blockade on our country. We call on the international organizations to stand by our side and help us to get the fuel in order to save our lives.
The Ministry of Health said over 1,500 medical facilities, including dialysis centers, are on the verge of total shutdown due to the lack of fuel. The ministry has urged the international community to step in and pressure the Saudi-led coalition to release the seized oil tankers.
Blocking oil vessels from entering the country threatens to stop many health facilities. There are more than 1,500 health centers and 400 laboratories and blood banks on the verge of closure. Centers that generate oxygen may also stop. The lives of patients may end within days. Patients with kidney problems are the most affected. There are more than 5,000 patients who need dialysis several times a week.
The United Nations says the Saudi war on Yemen, along with the years-long blockade, has driven the country into the world's worst humanitarian crisis.
Thousands of patients, including children, may lose their lives within days unless the international community breaks its silence and pressures Saudi Arabia to release the illegally detained oil vessels. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
About turning innovative ideas into practice. Toward Stars is the title of this exhibition, which puts on display the latest technologies that are made in Iran. A whole range of high-tech products, from mapping drones to smart medical equipment, are showcased here. Commander of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, Major General Hossein Salami, hailed the Iranian tech companies for helping to keep the national industries afloat amid foreign pressures.
In spite of the unilateral sanctions on our country, we have been able to serve our needs by tapping into our domestic resources and young minds. Technological development builds power and makes us independent from foreign powers. When a nation is independent, no other country can exert pressure on it.
The event was inspired by remarks made by leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, in August last year, where he put emphasis on the need to focus on science-based production and avoid exporting raw material and bulk goods, such as saffron. Given the fact that Iran produces 90% of the world's saffron, this Iranian producer has launched the so-called OSEC. It might sound music to the ears, since it rhymes with OPEC. Only the letter S stands for saffron. The Organization of Saffron Exporting Countries now is an established entity comprising 10 member states, with the goal to organize the global market.
The idea to set up the OSEC was driven by the fact that Iran, which has OSEC, is the hub of saffron production. But when it comes to exports, we are lagging behind. So OSEC seeks to organize the global market, not only for saffron, but with regards to caraway and caviar.
Well, there's a growing focus in Iran on commercializing indigenous products. This medical firm says the issue of marketing is still an alien word when it comes to Iranian-made products. But it says that's what it does.
Our company offers medical services in Iraq, Indonesia, and Afghanistan using Iranian-made equipment like hemodialysis systems and central water purification systems. In fact, we do the marketing job for Iranian manufacturers of medical equipment and offer the related services for our clients. We are working to find clients in more countries.
Iran has recently been trying to make a shift from an oil-based economy to other sources of income. The major drive behind such a move is to shield the economy from the ups and downs of oil prices. In recent years, such a shift is more vital, since Iran's crude sales have slashed as a result of U.S.'s unilateral sanctions against Iran.
This event comes as Iran is already rewiring its economy based on domestic production. This is significant, given the fact that U.S. sanctions against Iran have denied the country access to foreign trade. But Tehran regards the restrictions as a blessing in disguise, saying self-sufficiency is the fruit of sanctions. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Hundreds of Palestinian prisoners held in the Israeli military jail of Al-Aufer declared a set of measures, including a partial hunger strike, to protest excessive repression and assaults of the Israeli prison service that have been escalating dramatically. According to Palestinian Prisoners Club Association, prisoners in Al-Aufer jail have been subjected to harassment and repression, intensive provocative cell searches, and repeated raids on prisoners' rooms, especially at night. Prisoners have also been suffering from transfers from one prison to another, in addition to deliberate medical negligence.
Israeli measures are illegal and they are carried out against the prisoners in Ofer every day. That's why we say what goes on in Israeli jails amounts to a crime against the prisoners. Today the prisoners are suffering from medical negligence. We hold Israeli regime responsible for the consequences of these actions.
Talks have been held between prisoners and the Israel Prison Service. However, they have failed to meet the inmates' key demands. Thus, the prisoners will even escalate their protest measures within the coming days. Palestinian prisoners have been trying to resist the crackdown through all possible means, including boycotting military courts and going on hunger strikes.
Hunger strikes are almost the only means which the inmates have at hand to put pressure on Israeli authorities. Israel knows very well that the prisoners are able to achieve victory through their hunger strike and protest action as they did in the past.
Human rights organizations say Israel continues to violate all rights and freedoms granted to prisoners by the Fourth Geneva Convention and international laws. Today, over 4,500 Palestinians are languishing in a number of Israeli jails, according to Palestinian reports. Palestinian inmates have been subjected to systematic torture all through the years of Israel's occupation of the Palestinian territories. Those prisoners are behind bars in the first place for defying the Israeli occupation in all its forms. Mona Qandil, occupied Ramallah.
It's been almost 6 months since the first intra-Afghan talks in the Qatari capital, Doha, but so far, no viable agreement has been reached. The situation in Afghanistan has now become so complicated that the Afghan president is agreeing to hold an early election.
We stand ready to discuss holding free, fair, and inclusive elections under the auspices of the international community. We can also talk about the date of the elections and reach a conclusion.
Ashraf Ghani, however, strongly rejected a U.S. plan to form an interim government. The Afghan president said the only legitimate way to gain political power in Afghanistan is through elections.
Any institution can write a fiction on a piece of paper and suggest a solution for Afghanistan. These papers have been written in the past and will be written in the future. Our guarantee is our constitution.
President Ghani's comments came after calls for forming an interim government in Afghanistan increased in the past couple of months. This is why the U.S. Special Representative Salmai Khalilzad met some top prominent political leaders, tribal elders, and other influential figures during his recent visit to Kabul. The meetings soon faced mixed reactions. Many here say the main agenda of Khalilzad is to convince the Afghan president to accept an interim government and hold another round of talks in Turkish capital Ankara. While the Afghan government brands the establishment of any interim government as the death of democracy in Afghanistan, President Ghani's yes to an early election is considered as a green light for the Taliban to join a democratic process in order to gain power. Now, only time will tell whether or not the Taliban, the Afghan government, and the U.S. can make a comprehensive agreement or not. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Yemenis talk together in front of the UN office in Sana'a to slam the UN donor conference and renew their calls on the international organization and the international community to end the Saudi piracy against Yemeni oil ships.
We hope that they will talk about the ships of oil derivatives at the donors' conference. The Yemeni people need fuel just as they need food and medicine. There are thousands of trucks carrying aid that are parked in and could not reach the Yemenis because of the lack of fuel. We want serious action from the United Nations to release oil ships.
Protesters described the UN donor conference as a historical farce. Yemenis said the detained oil vessels must be released and the Saudi war as well as the blockade of Yemen must be stopped.
The donors conference is nothing more than a historical farce. We do not need humanitarian aid, but rather to lift the blockade and release oil ships.
The Yemenis do not need a donor conference as much as they need to bring in oil ships. And we do not want the United Nations to begin in the name of our dear people.
14 Yemeni oil ships remain at the Saudi-led coalition's detention illegally. The vessels were inspected and authorized by the United Nations through verification and inspection mechanism. The detention has led the country to a harsh shortage of fuel.
Yemenis say instead of raising funds for its organization's expenses, the UN must pressure Saudi Arabia to release the detained oil vessels if it wants to help the humanitarian situation. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Italy, disgruntled by the delay of vaccine supplies to Rome and general vaccine shortages in the EU, has called for a shipment to Australia to be blocked. By doing so, it is activating for the first time an export control system instituted by the bloc to make sure companies like the Anglo-Swedish drug maker AstraZeneca honour their contracts. Australia says its vaccine rollout will not be affected by the ban.
They are in an unbridled crisis situation. That is not the situation in Australia. But nevertheless, we've been able to secure our supplies. And additional supplies for importation both with Pfizer and AstraZeneca, which means we can continue the rollout of our program.
Out of 450 million Europeans, only 11 million have had a COVID-19 jab. Tired of waiting, countries like Denmark, Austria, Poland, Slovakia and the Czech Republic have given up on Brussels and turned to other suppliers. This week, Hungary received